Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. I'm Don Marsh. Our program today is going to focus on citizen science. It's not a term that may be fully understood by everyone, but it's an important and growing trend because it brings legions of amateur and or non-professional scientists together with the professionals whom they help in various research projects. We'll be talking about some of those projects today, including tracking the monarch butterfly, the local BioBlitz project, which uses volunteers to inventory biodiversity in our own environs, and about local frog watchers who monitor frogs and toads wherever they might be found. We begin by spending a few minutes with our own Veronique LaCapra, St. Louis Public Radio's science reporter, who is currently on temporary assignment with NPR's Science Desk in Washington. Veronique, very nice to hear your voice again.
And it's great to hear your voice, Don.
Give me your take on citizen science.
Well, citizen science is very, very useful to actual scientists, professional scientists, because it's a way to get a lot of data spread over a big area. And by, let me give an example. Just recently, I covered the Audubon Society's Christmas bird count. And that's something where they were expecting something like 60,000 people to participate this year from the United States, all over the United States, but also from Canada and from Latin America, really all over. And so, and all of that data that folks collect gets consolidated into a big online database that scientists anywhere can access and use any way they want to. And it's really something that would be impossible to do without the help of the public.
How is all of this coordinated and consolidated? I mean, we're talking legions of people out there.
Yeah, it's really kind of amazing. It's done in something called, they have these bird watching circles, and each circle is responsible for basically a 15-mile diameter circle of an area. And this, it's often the same people who come back year after year after year to look for birds. And the way that works is they have, it runs from December 14th through January 5th, at least it did this year, and they have to count as many birds as they can in 24 hours. So they can kind of pick the day that they go out and do this. But they're responsible for a particular, you know, sub area within that circle, each little team is. And they try to just spot and catalog all the species they can in a 24-hour period. And then all of that data gets consolidated by the person who's running that circle. And he sends it in, or she sends it in to Audubon, who then put it all together in this big online database.
And what did you find during your story?
Well, we had a great time. We got out there pretty early in the morning. It was still dark when we were out there, and we started off looking for owls. And the way they do that is they play the recording of an owl. Actually, they tried to three different species while I was there. And so they play this recording, and the hope is that a real owl will call back so that they can hear it and catalog it.
What kind of special training is necessary for these non-professional scientists?
Well, I mean, in a sense, none, although I will say that these bird watchers, one of them had been doing it for many, many years. He was sort of the leader of the group. Actually, two of the people in the, I had four bird watchers with me, and two of them had been doing it for quite a long time. And the other two were relatively new to it. And one of the ones who was new to it said to me, her name was Frances, and she said that she's never done anything as hard as this, that learning all the different bird calls. I mean, she really made it sound like sort of an academic program where she was really trying to learn the calls and learn how what the birds look like. And it really sounded like it took a lot of work. But all of these people, you know, they had regular office day jobs. These were not professional ornithologists by any means, but this was something they were really passionate about and were taking the time to learn.
You know, your time with us is somewhat limited. I know you can only stay through the half hour or to the half hour. Stay with us, Veronique, because I'd like to bring the other players in today's program into the conversation and have them kind of link up with some of the things that you've been talking about. Joining us by phone from Lawrence, Kansas is Chip Taylor, professor in the Department of Ecology and Evolutionary Biology at the University of Kansas. Chip's founder and director of Monarch Watch and science advisor for a new film coming to the Science Center OmniMax a week from Friday. It is titled Flight of the Butterflies, very special butterflies indeed, the monarch. We also have with us in studio Peggy Nacky, Special Events Director at the Academy of Science of St. Louis. She coordinates BioBlitz, which inventories biodiversity in our area. Mike Dawson is a naturalist with the St. Louis Zoo and St. Louis Chapter Coordinator of Frog Watch USA. say. I'll begin with you, Chip. You've been listening to Veronique. How does the citizen science play in the Monarch Watch process?
Well, we discovered the enthusiasm of the public a long time ago, and it was kind of fortuitous. We started out in 1992, and we put a couple of press releases out in the newspapers, and we were asking for taggers. We were asking for people to help us tag monarch butterflies. I had a little money, and I thought, well, the previous tagging program had stopped. I thought I'd like to get one going and see how it would go. Well, those news releases produced an unending number of phone calls from people who are really interested in getting involved in science. And I thought, wow, this is fantastic. I mean, the first call yielded about 500 volunteers. The second call yielded about 600 or 700 volunteers. And I thought, man, there's a thirst out there for wanting to participate in scientific endeavors. And this was 1992, so we were one of the early ones to get involved in all of this. And ever since, it's really taken off. We now involve probably 10,000 people in tagging monarch butterflies every year. And these people range from small children who are with their parents to people who are 80 and 85 years old. So we have an enthusiastic group of citizens out there that have helped us tag over 1 million butterflies in that 21-year period. And from that, we have something like about 12 or 13,000 recoveries, which is helping us learn a lot about this migration. I mean, the information that's coming back from all of this tagging is just tremendous. And so we've fed off of that, and we've fed back to all of those people to support all of their activities, and it's been a wonderful experience. And one of the things that's happened is through our program and a number of other monarch programs, we have created an interest in monarch conservation across the country, which has inspired a lot of people to get involved in a lot of other things involving monarch butterflies. And one of the things that I did in this past year was to recruit a group of people, which we call monarch conservation specialists. And these are people all over the country who are enthusiastically delivering the message that we need to do something to conserve monarch butterflies. And they're helping us in a lot of different ways get the message out and interacting with the public in ways that we couldn't. So we have these centers of activity involving these special people who are, in effect, recruiting their own citizen scientists in different areas of the country.
Is that what Monarch Watch is? Is it basically a tracking organization and conservation organization? Explain exactly what Monarch Watch is.
Well, we started out as kind of having a research emphasis. We were interested in the monarch migration from a research standpoint. We wanted to look at the migration and get some details and get the help from the citizens on this. And then we've kind of morphed into an educational organization, and for a long time we promoted science education using monarch butterflies in classrooms. We still do quite a bit of that. And then over the last 7 or 8 years, we've really morphed into a conservation organization where we became extraordinarily concerned about the future of the monarch population beginning in 2005. And so almost all of our efforts over the last 7 years have been spent trying to ramp up interest in monarch conservation, because we're going to lose this migration unless we pay attention to what's happening on the planet. Go ahead.
We can talk a little bit more about that migration, which is certainly a wonderful, mysterious story, if you will, in just a couple of moments. But I'm intrigued by this notion of tagging a butterfly. What precisely do you mean by that?
Well, it's really quite simple, and although it started out to be quite difficult. A tagging system had been developed by Fred and Nora Urquhart, who are Canadians, too, and they helped find the overwintering sites in Mexico, and that's part of the story that's going to be told in this Flight of the Butterflies film, is the discovery of the overwintering sites in Mexico. And so Fred Urquhart and his wife Nora put together one of the earliest citizen science programs, although it wasn't called citizen science at that time. And that program, in which they listed hundreds of people to help them tag monarch butterflies, used a method of putting a kind of a sticky tag over the leading edge of the wings. And when we got involved, we thought, oh, gosh, that's just going to kill too many butterflies. It's going to cripple them. It's really hard to teach people how to do this. So we eventually came up with a new tagging system in which essentially a round price tag-sized thing that you put on the bottom of a cup has been conformed to be a Monarch's tag. So we have these tags. Actually, they're printed in St. Louis. And these tags have got a special adhesive on the bottom of them. They come with a backing. You peel them off the backing, and you apply them to a special area on the wing of the butterfly. And the way we've designed this and where the butterfly is tagged allows the tag to stay on the butterfly for pretty much all of the life of the butterfly. I mean, we lose very few of these tags. And the butterfly can fly to all the way to Mexico bearing this tag. It only weighs about a 50th of the mass of the butterfly. It doesn't interfere with flight in any way. It stays on the butterfly, and we've even had butterflies recovered in Oklahoma that have been tagged the previous fall. So the tags stay on very well. It's a very simple thing to peel the tag off the backing and apply it to the butterfly in the proper place. Well, and kids as young as seven years old can do this.
We should point out that the average monarch butterfly weighs approximately what a penny weighs, as I understand it.
Well, probably even a lot less than that. They only weigh about half a gram.
I would like to bring in someone now who has been involved in the project, who is with the college school here locally. His name is Gerald Axenbaum. He's the fifth grade teacher at the school. Gerald, are you with us?
Yes, I am.
Tell us how you and the kids are participating in this project.
Well, we got involved actually when Chip started in 1992. I responded to one of those little ads that Chip had put in a newspaper. I had no idea what was involved in tagging. I'm not a naturalist. I'm not a life science teacher at all, or at least by training. But I just thought it might be interesting. And he sent me some information about what's involved in tagging, how you do it. And we started in 92, and we've been doing it every year but one year since then. And what's involved is basically teaching the students how to carefully handle a butterfly. Our students build their own nets in the classroom. They measure net material. They sew it. They assemble it on a dowel rod with a radiator clamp, which they love creating their own net. And then we teach them how to safely catch a butterfly or be more successful in catching it when it lands on a flower. And then how to safely take it out of the net without damaging the wings or the body. And then they learn how to identify the sex of it, how to apply the tag safely to it so it doesn't get damaged. We evaluate the wing condition of the butterfly, and then we release it and monitor which direction it flies when it flies away. And the kids are just thrilled at it. You know, the challenge of catching a butterfly is bigger than you might think. They're actually fairly hard to catch, especially if you miss them on the first swipe. And when they achieve this, there's a great sense of satisfaction. And then to tag it, hold it, grow attached to it, and then release it off to the wild and hope that it'll maybe get to Mexico is a great thrill for them.
And Chip, back to you. Once they've been tagged, you've got to catch them again.
Well, what happens is that most of the butterflies that are recovered in Mexico, and most of those that are recovered are found by the people who maintain the properties on which the monarchs overwinter down on the mountains in Mexico. And it takes them quite a bit of time to find each one of these tagged butterflies. Usually the only ones they can get are the ones that are dead on the ground beneath these great colonies of butterflies. And they shuffle through these dead butterflies for hours for every tag they find. And so in order to get the recovery information, we actually pay these people approximately $5 for every tag that they find and turn over to us. So sometimes that can cost us a lot of money, but every bit of these bits of information that comes back from Mexico is worth more than its weight in gold for the tag. It really is valuable. It's provided a lot of information about how this migration works and where the monarchs come from, and where they survive best to get to Mexico, and what sort of problems they have through the winter, and so on and so forth.
I have to take a break. There are many more questions I have, and we have other guests I want to get to as well. And I'll ask Gerald to stay with us for another couple of moments through this break, if you will. We'll come back and continue our conversation. We're talking about citizen science and some of the ways in which it's applied, and St. Louis has a pretty close connection with all of this. I was very surprised to learn that those tags that you're talking about are produced right here in our our city. We'll be back in just a moment. Chip Taylor is joining us from Lawrence, Kansas. He's with Monarch Watch. Gerald Axelbaum is a college school fifth grade teacher. He is with us briefly. I think Veronique LaCopper, our science reporter, is still with us in Washington. Come on into the conversation when we come back, Veronique. And Mike Dawson is also with us, along with Peggy James Dackey of the Academy of Science of St. Louis. Mike Dawson with Frog Watch here. Okay, all those names are out now. Let's go take our break and come on back and continue our conversation. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again, and welcome back to our conversation on citizen silence. My guests are Chip Taylor of Monarch Watch. He joins us from Lawrence, Kansas. Gerald Axelbaum of the College School in Webster Groves is with us for another couple of moments, talking about his involvement with Monarch Watch. Peggy James Nackey of the Academy of Science of St. Louis is with me in studio, as is Mike Dawson, who coordinates the St. Louis chapter of Frog Watch USA. Veronique LaCopra, a St. Louis Public Radio science reporter, joins us from Washington. Chip, let me just come back to you quickly with regard to the tagging once again. What information do you get specifically from these tags?
Well, surprisingly, we get information from every butterfly that is tagged. So every butterfly that is tagged, it provides us with information on where it was tagged, what day it was tagged, what latitude and longitude it was tagged at, and what sex it was. And that is actually more important in many respects than the recovery information, because that has told us a lot about the timing and pace of the migration. That has told us a lot about the differences along the coast from what we see in the center of the country and what we see along the Rockies, for example. I mean, the populations through the central part of the country are moving pretty much in concert, apparently with some sort of celestial changes. The populations that are moving across the coastal regions are moving apparently in response to a lot of physical factors, the wind in particular. And so this information on when and where the butterflies are tagged and the sex of the butterflies becomes very important. And then secondarily, it's the recovery information, which tells us if you tagged a lot of butterflies in Maine, do they survive as well as a similar number of butterflies tagged in Minnesota? And they don't. And that is important information as well. So we've gotten a lot of curious information about this migration simply by looking at the time and place at which the butterflies were tagged and the sex at which of the butterflies. It turns out that the sex ratio changes a little bit in terms of when and where the butterflies are tagged and who does the tagging and so on and so forth. So the butterflies that are caught on flowers tend to be a little bit more male biased than the butterflies caught in the trees, for example. And that's curious. We didn't know that before this.
Don, if I could just add something. This is, yes, Veronique in D.C. I think that's where citizen science projects work really well, is giving scientists this sort of big picture information. If I can go back to the Audubon's bird count for a moment, one of the things they've been able to see by getting all this data is that they can really see ranges of birds shifting in response to climate change further north, for example. And they can also see changes due to habitat loss or just changes in habitat, increasing urbanization and the spread of industrial scale agriculture. They're seeing declines in species that used to live in grasslands and shrublands. Those are declining. But birds that do well at the urban interface, birds that can use feeders, for example, like jays and cardinals, are doing really well. So that's the kind of big picture information I think these projects do really well at providing.
What happens, though, with this? And now you have the information, then what?
Well, I think that's where it gets, you know, it helps to guide conservation strategies, really. And, you know, particularly where another aspect of it with the birds is that these people are coming back to the same places year after year after year. So they can really see what's happening at that local level, too, where you see increasing development or changes in the way the birds are using the habitat. And so hopefully at the local level, that can be used to help guide, you know, more intelligent, more environmentally sound development, for example.
How many species of birds did you identify during your bird watch or bird count?
Oh, boy, I don't have that number on hand. I think they...
I thought it was upwards of 200.
It may well have been, yes.
That seems like an awful lot in a relatively small area, but what do I know?
Yeah, it's amazing. Well, this was a particularly rich area that we were in. It included a big wetland area, and so I know they saw many, many species there as well. And we did actually see an owl, so I was very happy about that.
Well, that's good. were many owls spotted by the group?
They only saw the one this year. It was a barred owl. But I think other groups within that 15-mile diameter area did see other owls as well.
Do you have any other projects coming up, Veronique, that would involve citizen scientists?
Nothing on the near horizon at this point, although I'm sure I'm going to be interested in finding out more about what's going on in St. Louis for when I get back.
Yeah, well, we're looking forward to seeing you back. That's going to be sometime in February, as I understand it.
That's right, beginning of February.
Well, we'll look forward to that. Veronique LaCapra, thank you so much for being with us. Keep up the good work. I'm sure NPR loves you. They might not let you come back.
All right. Well, thank you, Don. It's been great to speak with you.
Same here. Let me go back to Gerald Axelbaum again. And Gerald, thank you so much for being with us and holding on. I'll let you go after another question or two, but I need to know how these I need to know how these kids are responding to this. You've been doing it for some 20 years, as I understand it. What is their response to this exposure to this kind of nature?
Well, you know, I'm dealing with 10 and 11-year-olds here who are fifth graders. And in terms of citizen science, you know, it started with tagging butterflies through CHIP's program. But just by getting kids to start collecting information, it's just led to so many interests for us. It led us to start rearing butterflies in the classroom. So students get their own larvae to rear in our classroom that they take care of, they feed, they observe, they measure. And all the while they're collecting data, just like we did in the field with tagging butterflies, they're now collecting data about a larva that they're rearing. And that data then is used to make graphs, to look at the pattern of growth. It brings them in close contact with an insect or a species, which is our goal, to have kids connect to a species. We feel if they're very strongly connected to it, then they're going to want to preserve the world for that species. And I can't quite describe how strongly they get connected to it. They start to feel like they're a human being or that they're just their personal friend. And each day, monarch larvae happen to grow tremendously. In 2 weeks' time, they grow about 2,500 times their original size. So overnight, they're seeing a tremendous growth in the larva. When they come in each day, each morning, they see a change in it from eating monarch milkweed leaves overnight. And then they see it go through metamorphosis. They see it go into, they see it molt. They see what's happening in that process. They see it frass or lay feces down. They see the quantity of leaves it's eating increasingly each day. They see it go into the chrysalis stage, which is just a magical process to watch, and they see it eclose or come out of the chrysalis, which, again, is just an amazing thing to watch. After all these years, I'm still stunned by it each time I watch it. And then they see the butterflies mate and lay eggs in the cage. We have a flight cage in our classroom. And all the while, they're collecting information, recording information about it. So hopefully, to me, this is creating future citizen scientists, not just current ones. It will stimulate an interest in science for them, the value of collecting data. Once you have data, you can start to analyze it and draw conclusions from it. And just that fact alone, if you record information, then you can start to look at it and see what's happening with it. If you don't record it, you don't have anything to deal with.
You've been doing this for some 20 years or so. Do you have any sense of any of your students, former students, who have gone on to careers in science?
There are students who have gone on to careers in science. I don't track them. We're elementary to middle school, preschool through middle school. So I don't know that we've collected the data on how many graduates have gone on through high school and college to become scientists or engineers, but I think there's a fair number of them, and hopefully so.
Yeah,
but that would be an interesting piece of data to collect, actually.
It certainly would be, and I'm sure all our guests here would be interested in seeing what the results of compiling that data would be, because the study of sciences seems to be in relatively short supply in this country today. It seems to be taking a back seat to a lot of other things. Gerald Axelbaum, thank you so much, of the College School in Webster Groves. Thank you so much for being with us. Nice to have you. Now, let's get to our other guests. And Chip, stay with us. We're coming back to monarch butterflies, but I've got to get Peggy and I've got to get Mike into the conversation here. Mike, let me start with you. Frog watch. I guess frog watch is kind of a lot like monarch watch and like some of the things that Veronique was talking about.
It is. One of the things that's a little bit different, it's a little less invasive as far as you're not tagging anything. So you're seeing frogs and toads in more of a snapshot of their lives, of their entire life during the year, during the breeding season. And you're basically going out and listening to the frog calls, so you don't ever actually catch one or pick one up. You identify them by the frog calls, so you don't actually have to handle the animal or something like that, which makes it accessible to anybody that can learn the different frog calls They'd be able to identify them.
The anybody in this case being citizen scientists.
Citizen science. Quite,
yeah. Why is it important to do this?
Sure. It's important for a lot of reasons. Amphibians are important for the environmental impact that they make because of the food chain. They're a good indicator that the ecosystems could be changing or altering for many different reasons. One, if you look at pollution and stuff, they're a great indicator since a lot of them live in the wetland areas. And there's a lot of other good resources. One, there's an amphibian decline worldwide, which the United States also has a decline across the United States of a lot of different species. So studying those animals gives us something to show right away. They pick up a lot of different pollutions and chemicals in the environment very quickly, and their populations will show that.
If the population worldwide were to drop dramatically, what would happen?
They've estimated a good one-third or more than that, two-thirds of the population of amphibians worldwide is declining. You could easily in different areas, depending on the food chain, have collapses in different areas. If you look at different aspects as far as people, a lot of the different medicines that have been coming out of amphibians from the secretion of their skins are disappearing as well. So you can easily have a lot of problems.
So people who might be tempted to say, so what, really should understand that they play a very important role in our society and ecologically.
They very do. A lot of people use the analogy of the canary in a coal mine idea.
Ah. Peggy, let's turn to you now, and thank you for being so patient with us here. BioBliss, we talked about that a couple of months ago here on this program. Give folks a refresher course on what you're all about, what you're doing, and how citizen scientists play an important role.
Yeah, thanks, Don. BioBliss is an exploration of an urban park, is the formal definition. We started out our flagship BioBliss is at Forest Park. We've been studying Forest Park since 2004. We've branched out into Tower Grove Park and Creve Coeur Park. So what happens is we line up scientists in all different areas. We do have Philip Koning, who studies the monarch butterflies. He studies moths. We have engineers from CH2M Hill who study the waterways, and they did the redesign of the waterways in Forest Park several years ago, and we participate in World Water Day. So a lot of our data from the water droplets and the kids do analyze the droplets and is put into that database.
So, well, once you've compiled this information, what happens then?
We give the information to the park ecologists, wherever we're studying, and then they are using that data to see should they maybe perhaps be planting something different. Is there too much fertilizer being used? Is that having an impact, being that we are dealing with urban parks? We're developing this year on a kind of a worldwide web database that can showcase all of our findings to all. So we hope to have that completed by the end of the year.
Have there been any dramatic findings here in our parks, Tower Grove and Forest Park?
We've had some interesting finds. For example, they were very surprised to find an eastern pipistrelle, which is a species of bat in Forest Park. They didn't know that that was here. We've had a spider wasp that they didn't know was in our area. So we have had some unique finds. Of note, too, when you talk about the bird watch, I don't know if everyone's aware that Tower Grove has one of the largest diversities of birds in all of North America. There are so many different trees there. It's an attraction, and it is a landing ground for the birds. You'll talk to the local Audubon, and that is where they flock to look at the birds.
I'll bet you found a few geese in Forest Park as well.
Yeah, absolutely.
I always bring that up because I'm forever stepping over what they leave behind. Yeah. Mike Dawson, would it be possible for you to do what you do if it weren't for the help you get from average citizens?
No. It's impossible to get the amount of data that would be usable across the United States. And we have a chapter here, and there's chapters at a lot of the zoos opening up. And there's other organizations that also go out and catalog the species where and when they are. But without the citizen science, you wouldn't be able to get the volume of data that is usable to help make decisions and see patterns.
And Peggy, I'm sure the same is with you.
You know, absolutely. But a really big impact is to bring the citizens out. They love connecting with a scientist. So many times the only scientist a family knows is their pediatrician or their doctor. So when they get to come out and actually work with a naturalist or a scientist in their authentic research, they are very excited about it. It studies have shown that students in grades 6 through 12 will either opt in or out of science courses. And, Don, this is how they're going to set their path through high school. So we really like to get families involved and the lower grades involved in BioBlitz because it's going to set their course for the classes that they take.
Did I overstate the case a moment ago when I said that science seems to be getting somewhat short shrift in our schools today?
You know, what I'm finding is, and you're going to see, I hate to say that the standards are going to set the path for what teachers are teaching, but right now the national science standards are being evaluated and updated, and actually we have a consortium of teachers of all of the districts in our region that come together at the Academy of Science. They're actually meeting this Friday to talk about the new science standards and how they can incorporate that into their classrooms. Hands-on science is the authentic research, and it's the way to ignite students as they go through life in their school careers.
Chip Taylor, your take on all of that and the role that science plays in education today and what it should be playing.
Well, one of the things that we've seen in the course of Monarch Watch is that we have seen things change in the classroom because we export a lot of what we do into the classroom, as Gerald was talking about. And when No Child Left Behind came into the classrooms and where teachers were predominantly teaching to the test, interest in monarch butterflies in classrooms went down because the teachers simply didn't have the time to devote to this sort of thing. And I've got many complaints from teachers that they don't have time, haven't had time over the last number of years to really devote to sort of creative activities, activities that really engage the students apart from teaching them a particular formulaic way of knowing the world. And so this has, I think, been a disadvantage for a lot of the teachers we have dealt with, and I think this disadvantages the students as well. You're basically going to the lowest denominator, and you're going to a standard, and there's a lot of good things to say about going to standards, but if you are eliminating a lot of the creativity in the classrooms and you're taking a lot of the freedom away from the teachers to get some creative thinking in there and to explore the various things with our students, I don't think that is where we really need to go. I think we need to give our best teachers the best opportunities to use their creativity to bring the students into exciting new topics that aren't necessarily the three R's. So that's my take on all of that. But we are seeing things loosen up a bit right now. So we're getting back a little bit what we had before in terms of interest by teachers in doing things that are more creative in the classroom.
Peggy, I'll ask you to hold that thought. I have to take another break. But Peggy wants to respond or was prompted by something that you said, Chip Taylor. We'll bring her back into the conversation, as we will with Mike Dawson. Let me just tell folks in the listening audience that we'd love to hear from you with regard to citizen science, any role perhaps that you might have played in that or any interest you might have in getting involved. Give us a call at 382-8255. That's 382-TALK. You can send us an email at talk@stlpublicradio.org. We'll take a tweet at STL on air, and you can also reach us through Facebook. But we'll be back with our guests in just a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again, and welcome back to our conversation on citizen science. My guests in studio are Peggy James Nackey of the Academy of Science of St. Louis. Mike Dawson coordinates the St. Louis chapter of Frog Watch USA. He's also associated, naturalist, with the St. Louis Zoo. Joining us from Lawrence, Kansas is Chip Taylor of Monarch Watch, and he was an advisor on the film Flight of the Butterflies, which is going to be shown at the Science Center. I believe the startup date for that is January 18th. We'll check on that. But Peggy, I asked you to hold thought with regard to science in the schools. Go ahead.
Yeah, I think he was just mentioning perhaps a decline in science. I'm finding an uptake in the St. Louis region. We are having a thirst for citizen science when we throw out on our website information about the BioBlitz. Not only do I have the general public calling, I have teachers calling, I have waiting lists. I'm seeing a huge uptake. Additionally, the Academy of Science, it's science fair season. And, you know, the science fair, Don, is over 60 years old in the St. Louis region, and it is alive and well with over 50,000 students in the region participating. As far as citizen science goes, that's where you get down to the ground level where students have a question. Perhaps the year with the cicadas, I saw a lot more experiments in the lower grades for that. And I'm seeing an uptake in citizen science.
That's very encouraging to hear. And Mike Dawson, the St. Louis Zoo, of course, is also a teaching institution. What are you seeing there with regard to interest on the part of young people?
Sure. What I have noticed of all the students I work with and teachers, whether it's because of the curriculum-based, but a lot of them come with the science background of the genetics viewpoint. And I have found a lot of them, you know, they know more about genetics but couldn't identify a tree outside their own yard. So they've lost that connection to the outdoors.
But you had mentioned off the air that one of the things you're also seeing is a lot of interest through the social media.
There is. The social media, we're at a neat turning point to where it's becoming – it makes everything more accessible. You can put more things out there. People can easily communicate more. And with a lot of the technologies with the GPS, stuff is recorded. So if you record – any picture comes stamped with a GPS. So if you have a good – a picture of an animal identified – it'll tell you where and when it was taken. And so you now have usable database, and through data mining and be able to pull the data out, whether through Twitter, through Facebook, mm-hmm. it becomes a really neat way to look at data. It's out there, and now you can utilize it. And a lot of the young generations use it a lot better than I do.
Seeing the same thing, Peggy?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. One of the things that we offer to our Junior Academy students, which are kids in the region that join Junior Academy because they like science, is our GPS field trips. And actually, just like Mike, they're showing me how to use those GPSs and setting up courses and kind of going through it that way.
Chip Taylor, same with you?
Yes, sir. It's true.
Chip, what is killing monarch butterflies?
Well, we're losing a lot of habitat. And recently, that is of the last 10 years, we've lost a lot of habitat in corn and soybean fields. Now, that may sound strange, but milkweed is a low-level contaminant as a weed in corn and soybean fields. And it has been virtually eliminated due to the adoption of Roundup Ready corn and soybeans throughout the Midwest. I mean, we've got an adoption rate that's well over 90% for those two genetically modified crops. And as you may remember, when you have something that's genetically modified to resist a pesticide, you can go in and spray the pesticide. That's the purpose of this, spraying the pesticide on the crop, the herbicide, and it actually kills the weeds. Well, that has happened since about 2000 and to such an extent that it has had a major effect on the monarch population. But in addition to that, we've had a lot of habitat that was formerly milkweed and monarch habitat plowed up for the production of ethanol-based fuels. We've had a lot of development going on in the country. We lose about 6,000 acres a day just due to development. So there have been a combination of things. And over the last 10 years, we've lost at least 20% of the breeding habitat of monarch butterflies in the U.S. and Canada. And that's a major loss, and it's had a big impact on the population.
What is lost to humanity if we lose the monarch butterfly population?
You know, that's a really interesting question, and we've struggled with how to answer all of that. But, you know, these mysteries of life, these absolutely magnificent phenomena, these great migrations, to lose those things means that we are really losing a grip on this planet. We have to maintain the integrity of these resources out there because they, in turn, are resources for everything else. I mean, one of the things about the frog situation, the amphibian situation, is those animals are actually prey for a lot of other things. I mean, you can lose some major bird species if we lose their food supplies. And you know, the same thing applies to monarch butterflies. But more than that, you know, it's a phenomenon. It's a phenomenon that's not well understood. There's a lot of mystery associated with monarch butterflies, and these mysteries are intriguing, and they are things that we shouldn't really let go of. We shouldn't let this sort of thing decline. I tell you, if you go to see this movie, Flight of the Butterflies, the emotion that you get as somebody who does what I do, when you walk into that forest that's so full of butterflies, when you've got 25 million butterflies per acre out there, that takes your breath away. When the wind comes up or the sun comes in and literally tens of thousands of butterflies take to the air at once, so that the predominant sound, and you'll hear it in this movie, is the rustling of the wings of the butterflies, you say, we've got to keep this going. This is one of those magical things that we have on this planet. We shouldn't let it go.
We have a call from Tom in Afton, so let's bring Tom in because he's involved with this this whole monitoring process, if you will. Go ahead, Tom.
Thank you very much. Yeah, a few years ago, I was living in Minnesota in the Twin Cities area, and one day I was sitting in my dining room and saw a monarch come floating past the window, and it occurred to me that I might have some milkweed growing out there. So I went out to check, and sure enough, there were monarch caterpillars, and they were tiny. They were about the size of my pinky fingernail. And for some reason, that year, the monarchs had picked my neighborhood for egg laying, and I decided it might be fun to raise one, and I found the website of one of the monarch conservation and counting programs at University of Minnesota and got instructions on how to raise them. And what I learned is that they said the mortality rate for the caterpillars is about 90%. So I went and that if you raise them to be butterflies, once they become butterflies, the survival rate is about 90%. So I went all around the neighborhood and caught about 40. And I had a new project on my hands. And like your previous speaker mentioned, they eat a lot. And so I had to strip most of the neighbor's milkweed plants for leaves to feed all 40. And of the 40, 38 survived to become butterflies. And for adults and children, feeding those things, watching them grow the way we heard about, and releasing them is just a magical experience. And I would definitely recommend the tagging or conservation projects for people of all ages.
Tom, thank you so much for the call. Chip, you want to sign this fellow up?
No, this is the sort of thing we have people doing all over the country, and we love it. We hear stories like this all the time, and it's absolutely terrific. And, you know, every once in a while we'll get a call from a teacher and say, I didn't know about you guys, but, you know, I've been doing this for 30 years. And I think, yeah, this is right. What we need to do is connect all of these people into these activities. And it's great fun. They learn a lot. They engage a lot of other people, and they get a sense of connection to part of the world that really gives them a new perspective on things.
Peggy and Mike, Tom is the kind of guy that you would like to join you in your various
most
findings.
Definitely,
yeah. And this is exactly what we're talking about. As someone who finds an interest like this, pursues it, and stays with it, very valuable to you.
Yeah, I think we need to bring him in for the next BioBlitz.
When is the next BioBlitz?
You know what? We don't have a date. We're working with all of our organizations, but it will be in the fall at Tower Grove and also over at Forest Park.
All right. Let's go back to the phones. Jim is joining us from Brentwood. Go ahead, Jim.
Great show today, Don. I had the great good fortune several years ago to work with a group of teachers at McGrath Elementary School here in Brentwood, where my son happened to be a student at the time. And we lived out the dream of a former kindergarten teacher, Becky Bope. She always wanted to have an outdoor classroom. Well, in the process of building this outdoor classroom in a sort of an alcove of the school, we became citizen scientists. And it was funny because we didn't plan on that at all. All we wanted to do was build an outdoor space where the kids could, where specific teachers could have classrooms outside. In the process, every class, one through kindergarten through six, got a special space that they could grow their own vegetables or flowers or whatever. We put a pergola in, which turned out to be a butterfly magnet, and we learned about birds and butterflies and the entire gamut of science and outdoor living in the process. Like I say, we started out just thinking about an outdoor space that could extend the classroom and became outdoor scientists or citizen scientists in the process. It was really fun and a complete blessing, and it's still there today. and it continues to grow.
Well, what a great story. Thank you so much for sharing that with us. Appreciate it. I can't tell everyone listening to this how many emails and tweets that we've been getting from people who are talking about projects they're involved in. But one that catches my eye here, Jim Small, president of the St. Louis Astronomical Society, emails saying, there are many opportunities for citizen science online. One of the largest is the Zooniverse. Or Zooniverse, Zooniverse, found at www.zooniverse.org. So if you're interested, that might be helpful. Chip, one of the things that I wanted to spend some time talking about, we've been kind of all around the block on so many different subjects here. Tell us in a capsulized version, if you will, about this migration, because it is, as you say, a mystery. But these little critters come to all parts of this country from Mexico. Tell us about that.
Well, just very quickly, what happens at the end of the overwintering season, which is really about the end of February and March, it takes about 6 months for all the 6 weeks for all the butterflies to leave Mexico. But they begin leaving Mexico at the end of February. They get into Texas early in March. They move into Texas progressively over several weeks, and the females coming north lay eggs on the milkweed. They produce a generation really in about the southern half of the U.S. up to about 35, 40 degrees north latitude, which is almost almost to the St. Louis area. And then those offspring that are produced on the milkweeds in the southern part of the states, they take wing at the end of April, early May, and they take this migration all the way up to the limits of milkweed. And then you get two or three other generations in the northern states in this northern breeding area. And then the monarchs begin to move south again. If you're up as far north as Winnipeg, they begin moving south at about the 10th of August. And then this migration picks up speed and picks up butterflies as it moves south, so that by the time they're reaching St. Louis, it's probably around the 10th of September. And then this migration moves through for about 3 or 4 weeks, and they progressively move south, again entering Mexico. And at the overwintering sites at the end of October. So you got about a 5 month overwintering period. You've got about a 6 week exodus from Mexico, about a 3 months to 4 months period where they're breeding, and then you've got a 2-2.5 month migration to get back to where they overwinter again. It's a pretty incredible phenomenon because it involves hundreds of millions of insects.
And that's all going to be chronicled in Flight of the Butterflies, which is going to be showing starting on the 18th at the Omnimax. Peggy and Mike, let me come to you. Time is limited, but very quickly, what did you want to say here today that maybe you didn't have an opportunity to say?
Well, I do want people to check, of course, the Academy website, because that's where they're going to see upcoming science activities. It's academyofsciencestl.org. There's notes on there for the science fair, for science seminars that we partner with the zoo and other organizations around town. Of course, we haven't even talked about, there's so many subjects in science, but the Alaska Wilderness is organization is coming to the zoo for a science seminar, another opportunity for the public to connect with scientists in the region through the Academy of Science.
And you're always looking for volunteers. I'm sure they can do that through the website.
Absolutely.
As well. And Mike, very quickly from you.
Sure, you got it. The frogwise season is coming up. It starts in about February to August. So we have trainings coming up starting at the end of January. So check us out on the St. Louis website and sign up and make a difference.
All righty. And Chip, a final thought from you in 15 seconds?
Plant milkweeds, folks. We need to get that milkweed out there. We've lost so much habitat that we've got to replace that habitat if we want to keep this migration going.
Well, Chip Taylor, we thank you so much for being with us. I've only seen the trailer for this film. You were an advisor on that, but it looks absolutely sensational. Photography is wonderful. Looking forward to that. Thank you very much, Chip Taylor of Monarch Watch. We thank Peggy James Nacki for being with us of the Academy of Science of St. Louis. Mike Dawson, that is, coordinates the St. Louis chapter of Frog Watch USA. Thank you all so much for being with us in a very crowded hour. Certainly appreciate it.
Thank you, Don.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Tomorrow, join Steve Potter for Cityscape for our monthly soundbite segment in partnership with Sauce Magazine. He'll talk with the owner chef of Little Country Gentleman in Clayton about, among other things, the molecular gastronomy style of cooking. Monday on St. Louis on the Air, we'll talk with the new chief of the Metropolitan St. Louis Police Department. That would be Chief Sam Dodson. Then join me in person Tuesday morning in the St. Louis Public Radio Community Room for a conversation with conductor Leonard Sletkin. To be part of the audience, just arrive at 3651 Olive by 10:45. No tickets needed. That's guaranteed to be an enjoyable hour. Archived versions of past St. Louis On the Air programs available for download or podcast at stlpublicradio.org. St. Louis On the Air, produced by Mary Edwards and Alex Hoyer, with production assistance from Aaron Dorr and Spencer Reed. Executive producer is Robert Peterson. St. Louis On the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Don Marsh.